This is a Triple J podcast.
Every billionaire is a douchebag.
Parliament is a sick place.
I thought, oh my God, I might be an alcoholic. Obviously, I'm an inadequate guest.
No, that's not what I'm saying.
Who's the Prime Minister?
When you think about incredible feats of human endurance, few things conjure as much wonder and danger as climbing the tallest mountain in the world, Mount Everest. Each year, hundreds of climbers face the risks of altitude sickness, extreme cold, avalanches, brutal weather to take on the mountain. And hundreds have died trying. So what drives people to push themselves despite the risks? It's Angel Parsons with you for Hack today. I'm filling in for Dave Marchese, and coming up in the show, we hear what it's like climbing Mount Everest and honestly why you would do it, because this year's climbing season on Everest is believed to be the busiest in history. And among those who've made it to the summit is an 18-year-old Year 12 student from Australia.
When we're in our tent in Camp 4 waiting to leave, the emotions are so high. You know that this is going to be the hardest day of your life.
Yeah, the youngest Australian to ever summit Mount Everest. We'll be speaking with her soon. Also coming up, fighting between Israel and Hezbollah has been intensifying. But has Donald Trump convinced both sides to hold fire? First, though,
Hack.
If you allow these people to accumulate all of the wealth in the world, then the obvious consequence is you will have no wealth.
On Triple J.
Yeah, that was the warning from economist Gary Stevenson. You might remember when he spoke to us on Hack earlier this year. And today, there's new data that shows he might have been right, because there are more billionaires today than ever before in Australia. And their combined wealth has been growing by $50,000 per minute. Let me know how this news sits with you, knowing there are now 178 billionaires in Australia. You can text in on 0439 757 555. Are you happy for those who can make that much money? Or do we need to be taxing wealth differently? In Parliament House today, one of the big conversations was around Labor's tax reform, changing how the capital gains tax discount works. We'll hear more soon about the impact this will or won't have. Will it address wealth inequality? But first, Jackson Worthington's here to bring us up to speed.
We want to make sure that every single member on that side comes in and owns this deceit.
This side supports workers and first home buyers, and that side does not.
Today, the Albanese Labor government restores our end of the bargain.
Beneath Labor's weasel words is a budget that is a massive con job.
For the past few weeks, there's been one topic that has dominated headlines, social media feeds, and radio across the country. Tax. And today was no different, because the government's changes to negative gearing and the capital gains tax were introduced to Parliament.
Labor is the party of aspiration.
Just a quick refresher, Labor wants to limit negative gearing to new builds. Negative gearing lets you pay less tax if you make a loss on a rental property. And they're planning to scrap the 50% capital gains tax discount too, implementing a discount based on inflation and a minimum 30% tax on capital gains. Those capital gains changes will only apply to gains accrued after July next year, and properties owned before the budget announcement would be exempt from the negative gearing changes. And all of this needs to pass Parliament before coming into law.
This week and this government is all about higher wages and lower taxes for workers and a fair go for first home buyers, Mr. Speaker.
The Treasurer says these changes are about addressing intergenerational inequality and giving young people a fair go. And coincidentally, they were introduced on the same day. New analysis from anti-poverty group Oxfam showed there are more billionaires in Australia than ever before. Here's Oxfam CEO Jennifer Tierney.
The 20 richest people in Australia hold more wealth than the bottom 3 million households.
The government resisted calls for a wealth tax and a new tax on gas exports in this year's budget. It still says the reforms introduced today are significant and will shake up the tax system.
Those opposite cling to a broken status quo which has been locking too many Australians out of housing.
But they've been quite controversial.
More taxes does not mean more prosperity.
In Parliament today, opposition leader Angus Taylor called the changes toxic and urged the Prime Minister to put them to a vote.
And if you don't have the courage to call an election now,
We will make the next election a referendum on these tax increases, Mr. Speaker, one way or another. Hard-working Australians will have their voices heard, and we will ensure that is the case.
Hack on Triple J.
Jackson Worthington reporting there. And look, these changes have sparked a lot of conversation. So we're going to take a step back and look at why and how we tax in this country and whether we're doing it right. Evan Lucas is an economist, economic futurist rather, and he's with us now to give us his take. Evan, thanks so much for joining us on Hack.
Thanks for having me, Angela.
So let's go back to basics for a second, Evan. Why do we pay tax in this country?
Yeah, so I'm glad we sort of start there because I think we hear all these things about, you know, this tax is changing or this is happening and this is... Don't forget, tax is actually a good thing. Tax is there for the government to fund the society that we live in with activities and services that we need. So you think about from federal, state, local government, those things that you touch every day as soon as you walk out your front door is funded by your taxes. So the roads that you walk on and drive on, the health system that you touch, the education system that you touch, the, you know, federal funding of overall prosperity, all of that is why tax is raised and what we need tax for. So we've got to remind ourselves that when we live in a society, we do need a tax because it's for the good of all. The debate, however, comes, Angel, about who gets taxed, what, where, and what priorities that is better for society depending on who's in power.
And how do we pay tax? What are some of the main elements that we're taxed on in life?
I'm sure all of you out there know very well that every time you get your pay packet, you can see that a certain amount has been taken out in tax. So let's start at personal income tax. One of my little inverted commas crusades, shall we say, Angel, is the amount of personal income tax that we pay in this country. So it is at the moment, according to the latest budget papers, which came out on the 12th of last month, 54% of the federal government's revenue comes from you, me, and everyone listening working. Now, that is a lot. And it needs to be pointed out that proportionately, compared to our global peers, we do have a fairly high level of personal income tax. So that's the number one taxation model for the feds. The next level for them is corporate tax, which is the 30% tax on corporations. If you put that in with the personal income tax, the total tax revenue now is between 72 and 75%. Then every other tax you can think of, you know, the tax on superannuation or the tobacco, alcohol and gambling taxes, the profit tax, the petroleum resource rent tax, all these other federal taxes, they make up the rest. Then you can go to the state level. I'm sure if you've tried or are looking to buy a home, you've heard about stamp duty. You think about your council rates. That's a local council there. But you've also got things like, you know, parking fines, police fines. They're all taxes as well, technically. And it's all part of that mix to fund the services that we talked about at the start.
The reason that a lot of people are bringing up this idea of tax reform at the moment is because people want action on intergenerational inequality, and they're putting forward reforms to the tax system as a way that we can address that. In your view, how does Australia's tax system contribute to this idea of intergenerational inequality?
That's certainly there. So particularly for young people, probably post 2015, 16, where we saw a real takeoff in the cost of education, they have gone to university, TAFE, for some form of study to obviously improve their skills so when they come out into the workforce that they will then be able to earn an income that not only allows them to get ahead of the cost of living but actually thrive. The thing is, though, because things have moved up in price, because to keep ahead of that price, you work harder, you move up the tax brackets and you move through them. Bracket creep, as I'm sure you may have already heard, means that that almost subliminal contract with society is breaking down. You know, why it makes it so much harder for intergenerational wealth is because once upon a time, working allowed you to get a wage that could then contribute to a deposit to buy a home. Now, it's not that clear cut.
So what do you think should change?
They need to change the tax mix. Now, we are talking about capital gains tax, and we heard in the package before about the debate that's going on there. But the reason someone like myself and most economists at the moment are putting their hand up going, this is just not moving the dial for intergenerational wealth. You have to talk about all of it. And that's not just personal income tax. It's things like the dreaded GST. But if you were to actually move the GST for argument's sake, Angel, to 15%. What you could do is then actually completely remove the 15% tax bracket to compensate the lowest economic group in this country, to make sure that every dollar that you earn, that you actually get to keep. But the way that you're paying the taxes you need to pay to society is through the consumption of the products that you have. That would therefore move proportionately away from putting too much pressure on the lower socioeconomic group, allowing young people to get ahead, to actually keep the money that they're working for. That's why this is such a massive discussion at the moment, and why intergenerational inequality has been decades in the making. And if you want to change it, it isn't just about looking at capital gains tax and negative gearing. It's about the whole system.
And speaking of, you know, what's fair and how young people can get ahead, something today I know a lot of young people, especially in Hack's audience, are frustrated with today is this news out that Australia now has 178 billionaires. We're up 17 since last year. So Australia has more billionaires than it's ever had before. What does that tell you?
It tells me that Australia is becoming more and more prosperous, but it does also tell me that the disproportion between the haves and the have-nots is growing. Again, how you evaluate them being a billionaire is, it's not necessarily the, you know, the money in their bank account, it's the assets that they hold. So let's take the richest person in this country, which is Gina Rinehart. It's the fact that she owns pretty much the entire Roy Hill project and other parts of the Pilbara. It's the assets behind it. So housing's the next one. The second richest person in this country is Harry Trigardoff, and he's a property baron. So it's the appreciation in assets. Now, what does that actually mean in terms of what they pay for tax, how they contribute to society, and how you actually sort of touch somebody with assets rather than somebody with an income?
Labor says it is really trying to address this problem of inequality between generations, and that it is shaking up the tax system with these changes to capital gains tax. I'm curious to get your take. Do you think these CGT changes will make a difference? Will it affect these billionaires that we're speaking about?
It won't affect them hugely. The changes to CGT on property make sense. Like, I think that needs to be put out clearly. It will slow the market down. That is needs to happen. It's growing well and truly above trend. But once you start applying it to other asset classes, it does become a bit of a problem and a bit of a headache, particularly when you look at things like if you're saving for a deposit on a home, as an example. That is where we know that because the cost of living is so high, because inflation is running at the moment, you've got to actually somehow keep above inflation and still keep saving and growing your deposit, which means you have to invest, right? You can't get ahead by just saving with, you know, a cash deposit or your income. Generation Z is the most switched on investment generation we've ever seen. But the changes to the new CGT means that it's going to take you just that much longer because you've got to pay just that much more tax when you go to sell those assets in the future. It does help on the housing debate. There is clear evidence it doesn't help on others.
It's really great to hear your perspective on all of this, Evan. There's a lot of, you know, divided views out there on wealth inequality and how we should be addressing it here in Australia. And we really appreciate you giving us your take. Evan Lucas, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you for having me, Angel.
And hearing from you on the text line, someone says the issue isn't about how we get our taxes, it's the way our taxes are spent. So much money is wasted on unnecessary spending, that person says. Another person saying, though, being a billionaire is inherently unethical. No one can become a billionaire without exploitation. We're going to move on.
Hack.
Iran has called off all negotiations with the United States to end their war until Israel stops its attacks on Lebanon.
On Triple J.
Yeah, we're going to take a look at what's been happening in Lebanon and how that affects the chances of a ceasefire in the Middle East. Because Iran announced it was protesting Israel's actions in Lebanon by pulling out of negotiations with the US. So, US President Donald Trump has intervened, as Alice Angeloni reports.
As rockets were fired back and forth between Israel and the Iranian-backed militant group Hezbollah in Lebanon, there was a diplomatic back and forth happening too, between the United States, Israel, Iran and Hezbollah.
The situation in Lebanon is deeply alarming, marked by Israeli ground troops pushing further north into Lebanese territory and intensified Hezbollah attacks reaching deeper into Israel.
As US President Donald Trump tries to get an increasingly shaky ceasefire back to stable ground. Let's back up a bit.
It all began when the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced he had ordered the Israeli military to launch strikes on Beirut's southern suburbs.
Yesterday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced it was expanding its ground invasion of southern Lebanon.
Together with the Minister of Defense, I instructed the IDF to attack terror targets in Beirut.
A day after its ground forces reached their deepest point in Lebanon in 26 years, all as Hezbollah continued to fire rockets at northern Israel.
We continue to deepen our activity on the ground in southern Lebanon, eliminating Hezbollah strongholds.
The Lebanese Prime Minister has accused Israel of collective punishment and says it's pursuing a scorched earth policy.
Dahiya is a densely populated suburb of southern Lebanon, often referred to as a Hezbollah stronghold. And within minutes of Prime Minister Netanyahu's warning, families were packing up their cars. The streets jammed as people tried to flee.
Are you guys leaving?
This woman tells me she is, but she's okay with it. Even if we're struck, we will support Hezbollah. She says it will be victorious.
Israel says it's fighting to stop the barrage of rockets and drones fired from Lebanon by Hezbollah. The Israeli Defense Force today saying it intercepted two rockets launched from Lebanon, while Israeli communities say they're exhausted by the constant threat.
A normal person cannot stand the crazy situation we have here. Only with drugs a person can continue on functioning.
And even before Benjamin Netanyahu's latest warning, Israel had already been intensifying and expanding its military action in Lebanon. For weeks, the US was thought to be pressuring Israel to limit its action in Beirut. Which brings us to Iran.
Iran has said that if Israel's planes do strike this city, it will in turn target northern Israel.
Iran wants any wider peace deal to include Lebanon too. And the latest threats from Benjamin Netanyahu prompted warnings from Iranian officials, including Foreign Minister Abbas Araghchi. He posted to social media saying the US-Iran truce was unequivocally a ceasefire on all fronts, including Lebanon, and that its violation on one front is a violation of the ceasefire on all fronts. So overnight, the US intervened.
US President Donald Trump says there will be no troops going to Beirut after speaking with Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu.
In a post to Truth Social, Donald Trump claimed Israel and Hezbollah have agreed to stop attacking each other after he had conversations with both of them, communicating with Hezbollah through mediators. Donald Trump saying,
I had a very productive call with Prime Minister Bibi Netanyahu of Israel. And there will be no troops going to Beirut, and any troops that are on their way have already been turned back.
And also claimed,
I had a very good call with Hezbollah, and they agreed that all shooting will stop, that Israel will not attack them, and they will not attack Israel.
This is with a group that is listed as a terrorist organisation by several countries, including Australia. It marks the end to another tense moment in the Middle East.
It appears that the pressure valve may have somewhat been released as a result of this intervention by the US President Donald Trump.
With talk of lasting peace still ongoing.
This is Hack on Triple J.
Alice Angeloni reporting there. And now a bit of a gear shift. We're going to move on and talk about climbing Mount Everest.
Hack. I know what it's like. It's very scary. But for an 18-year-old, it would be even more daunting.
On Triple J.
Yeah, when you think about pushing yourself to the limit, the great tests of human endurance, climbing Mount Everest is really up there. It's a deadly climb, from brutal weather, altitude sickness, avalanches. Many who set out to reach the summit never return. It's a massive achievement for many in the mountaineering community, but others worry about over-tourism. This year's Everest climbing season is believed to be the busiest in the mountain's history. So what drives someone to want to do this, to confront the danger head on, know the risks and push ahead anyway? Well, we're about to meet someone with the answers to these questions and who's going to let us in on what it's like climbing the tallest mountains on Earth. Bianca Adler has just become the youngest Australian to ever summit Mount Everest. And I'm happy to say Bianca is joining us now. Hey, Bianca, welcome to Hack.
Hi, thank you.
Firstly, congratulations. I mean, you're home now in Melbourne, back at school, doing year 12, like a completely different world to how you've spent the last few months. I mean, how are you feeling?
It's very overwhelming, to say the least. It's such a shock going from such an extreme physical environment to now having to put all my focus towards school, and it's a complete shift of focus, and it's quite overwhelming, really.
I literally can't imagine. I mean, the feelings you've had these last few weeks, I don't know how many people can say that they relate or have felt like this. And I'm keen to hear more about, you know, the moment you summited and what it's all been like since then. But first, can we talk about the lead up, like how you got here? Is this something that you've known for a long time that you wanted to do?
Yes. So both of my parents have actually climbed Everest. So they've always sort of raised me with a love for the outdoors, but never obviously forced me into doing anything as extreme as this high altitude mountaineering. But I gradually sort of progressed in my ability to do harder hikes and harder rock climbing grades. And I just loved having these big goals. And I sort of knew I wanted to do Everest at some point, but I never thought I would have the experience to do it so young. But I've just had lots of different experiences on other mountains that have led me to this point and, yeah, to be able to do Everest at 18.
And how did it move from, you know, hiking with your family to making this pretty extreme decision to climb Mount Everest? Do you remember, you know, what made you finally decide to do it?
Well, it definitely wasn't just one decision. Mm. I gradually progressed in my mountaineering and I just love it so much and I don't want it to end at Everest. And even as a family, we went to Everest Base Camp when I was 14 and my brother was 12 and I saw Everest for the first time and that was really the moment when I realised that I was going to summit that at some point. I was definitely going up there.
Last year, you went over there and you attempted to climb Everest. You did have to turn around at 8,500 metres, right? So close to the top. I mean, talk us through this first attempt and what was going through your head then.
I trained really hard last year as well. I had done 98% of the expedition and unfortunately I had really bad weather. Yeah, it was devastating and it was really hard to have something out of my control. Yeah, I didn't want to risk losing my fingers or toes to frostbite from the wind. I have no regrets about that decision and it made me even fitter this year, even stronger. And yeah, I was able to enjoy it even more this year.
Take us to the start of your climb. Like, who are you with? How does it all kick off?
Yeah, it's a huge process and I didn't want to go into it just thinking about the summit. But I started out with my dad and he did most of the expedition with me. He was such great support. And I was also climbing with two Sherpa guides. So one of them is Pemba, who I was climbing with last year. And he's incredible. We have such a great bond. Really special to have someone that I trust really well. And I was also with Nudu, who is his brother-in-law. He's super funny, super nice. And I'm really happy that I got to share the summit with them as well.
And I'm really keen to ask you a little bit more about your relationship with the Sherpa guides a little later on. Can you first just talk us through like the logistics of this climb and the rotations you need to go through? Like you aren't just climbing up and up and up every day, right?
So our rotation is when we spend a few nights up on the mountain, usually about a week, and then coming back down to base camp. That allows our body just to acclimatize, create more red blood cells, and just get used to those higher altitudes. And yeah, then it's just a big waiting game for the weather window for your summit push.
What's going through your mind when you're on your way to the top and then when you reach the top?
When we're in our tent in Camp 4 waiting to leave, the emotions are so high. You know that this is going to be the hardest day of your life. There's a lot of accidents that happen. It's very dangerous up there. At these altitudes, people can make mistakes. You never know what the mountain's going to do. I was also thinking about all the people back home that are watching my journey as well. It's just so much that's going through my head, so many emotions. But as soon as I step out of the tent, it all goes away and you just start focusing just on the climbing. I remember my goal when I was climbing up on my summit day at those altitudes, just because of the lack of oxygen, my goal was to be doing about 7 steps without stopping and then having a little break and then another 7 steps. My heart rate was really high doing that. Like, it's really tough. I was actually in the dark, though, once I was arriving towards the summit. That's because I wanted to avoid queues, so that I arrived at the summit at 2 in the morning. It was just the very small price I had to pay to be able to have a safe summit and not be sort of caught up in the queues whilst I'm going down. Other people might be going up. When there are a lot of queues like this, there are accidents.
So you're in the darkness, but you're there. You're at the top. How does that feel? And does it feel how you thought it would?
It's not a very euphoric feeling. Well, at least for me, it wasn't. And I didn't want it to be, because I wanted to stay super focused on the way down. Yes, I did have that moment of, wow, I'm on top of the world, but I sort of had so far to go still. Yeah, but it was very special.
This is Hack. I'm Angel Parsons and I'm speaking with Bianca Adler, who's just 18, still at school, and has become the youngest person to summit Everest. Bianca, a lot of people are probably quite baffled, really, as to why you do this, why you put yourself at such risk. What is your reason?
Oh, I get so many questions like this and I still don't really know myself. So I just have such a love for being in the mountains. And then on the other side, I also just have this love for building up and working towards big physical goals. And I think mountaineering is just the perfect combination of the two. Yes. I love being in discomfort. Yeah, I love just that feeling of accomplishing something and just seeing if I'm able to do it or not.
Did you feel like you had to make peace with the risks? And one of those risks being that you could die during this. How do you grapple with that?
I was really confident in the experience I had. The more I do these sort of hard mountains, the more I realize that a lot of these risks that we take on the mountain, we can actually play a big role in controlling. There are, of course, many things that we can't control. Just something I tell myself if I'm scared up there. I have made that decision back there, and then now that I'm here, I just have to go along with the decision that I had already previously made.
You said that before, how you summited in darkness to avoid the queues for your own safety. I'm keen to ask about, like, you know, just how many people are climbing Everest at the moment. You know, there are concerns about over-tourism, impacts on the environment, and also about whether the Sherpa are exploited. I mean, how do you feel about some of those concerns?
There are a lot of concerns about queues and overcrowding. The day that I summited was the day that had the most Everest summits in history, but I had seen those queues behind me, so I made the decision to leave a little bit earlier than most people.
And as for people's concerns about how the Sherpa guides are treated, what was your experience like with your guide, and did you ever feel conflicted about that?
We go with a local company that treats their Sherpa guides well. You know, we climb with them, we climb alongside them. We don't expect anything sort of unrealistic from them. Yeah, I really see Pemba as my climbing partner. I see us as a team and not them doing something just for me.
You know, the title that you have now of being the youngest Australian to summit Everest, when you hear those words, what does it mean to you to be that person?
I mean, I definitely don't do it for the records, but yeah, it does mean a lot. I have so much respect for Gabby Canizé, who was the previous youngest Australian. She's incredible, and I really look up to her a lot.
What do you think your future has in store?
I'm not sure, but definitely more 8,000 metre peaks at some point. But yeah, now just focusing on school, just completely shifting my focus from sort of survival to now my essays and my assignments and pretty much only that.
Bianca Adler, thank you so much for coming in and sharing your experience with us. It's like nothing else. And yeah, we appreciate you opening up today. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And that is all we have time for on Hack today. I do want to say I've loved seeing all your text coming through on wealth inequality, the subject we were talking about earlier, finding out that Australia has more billionaires than ever before. Hannah says, if the billionaires could donate some to me, that would be stellar. Totally. Someone else is saying every billionaire is an example of a broken system. That is all we have time for on Hack today.